right, we're going to pick up with Joshua chapter 5 at about verse 13. Now, we ended up last week, we talked about the fact that the Israelites, for the first time since they left Egypt, were circumcised, and then they celebrated Passover. Okay, now, put the whole setting in order. They've been miraculously led to cross the river. They renew the covenant with the rite of circumcision, and then they enter into a celebration of the Passover, which celebrated their deliverance from Egypt. So they have had a short, high-intensity spiritual season. Okay, they finally crossed the river into the Promised Land miraculously. They renew the covenant, and then they celebrate deliverance. And now, sitting before them is Jericho. What do we know about Jericho? It was a big city. It was a walled city. They say that the walls were so thick you could drive a chariot on top of them. So yeah, it was a big city. It was strongly fortified. And you got a bunch of wanderers that have had basically no military training are going to lay siege to that city. Now, the analysts, all those people in the think tank down at the Pentagon, say, you got to be kidding. This can't possibly succeed, right? So, as we come to the 13th verse of chapter 5 of the book of Joshua, it doesn't really give us a lot of clarity here, but apparently Joshua is alone. I can imagine him on the eve of the battle, walking away from the encampment, maybe coming up on the crest of a hill, and just looking at Jericho. A little alone time, him and God. Just a little alone time to sit there and look at that city and say, you know, I believe God's going to hand that to me, but I just really can't see how. You know? So Joshua is there. We find in verse 13 it says this. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. What's your first reaction, Bay?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Run, draw my sword, do something, right? Joshua went up to him and asked, okay, man standing there with a drawn sword. Joshua strolls up to have a conversation with him. Are you for us or for our enemies? Neither, he replied, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. I'm going to stop for a second. Let's get this picture. Joshua's out there apparently by himself. And here is this person who wasn't there a minute ago, standing there with a drawn sword. He doesn't run. He doesn't attempt to defend himself. How can you interpret that?
He didn't know who it was.
You think there was some inkling there that this might be a messenger from God? Well, those things just don't happen every day. You know? I wonder what Joshua was thinking. Was he praying? It says that he looked up and saw the man. You know, does that mean it was his head bowed? Was he in prayer? Was he in thought? What was he possibly doing
there? Or was
there?
He just resting?
He could have been thinking that God told him that he was going to take the city, so he knew that he was safe, so he was just curious. He said, whose side are you on?
Yeah, Joshua knew because of what he was upbringing. He saw the pillar of smoke and the fire. So he knew God's protection and God's providence. So he knew that God was going to take care of him.
And had he not been promised, just like I was with Moses, I'll be with you.
Yep.
Well, how did God make himself manifest to Moses?
Through a burning bush.
Through a burning bush. Through his words. You know, there were some times later on that Moses almost debated with him, huh? He questioned him. You know, hey, did you bring these people out here in the wilderness just so they could die? Then people are going, your reputation is going to suffer on this one, God. So, you know, but God said, as he was with Moses, so he would be with Joshua. So maybe Joshua was out there even that time looking for some reinforcement, needing that spiritual reassurance. Don't we have that problem?
Yeah.
You know, don't we have those days when we just need God to show up with his drawn sword? So Joshua wasn't afraid. You know, how many times did he say, be strong and courageous? Don't fear. How many times do we repeat that in these earlier chapters? Well, maybe this is the first incident where he had to be strong and courageous and not fear.
And so I think too that he was probably asking how to take the city. You know, getting the instructions mm-hmm. from God. I think he was probably asking.
Could well have been.
And I think also it reminds me to, when you see something like that, you know, the Bible says to try the spirits to see if it's God or not. So that's his first thought is, I don't know if you're for me or against me.
What do you suppose would be Joshua's response if he said, I'm against you?
That guy's probably been looking at the soles of his feet.
I think he would have done the same thing he would have done in this verse. He would have fell face down and prayed.
I'm not sure.
I
kind of see it the other way a little bit.
I think if he was bold enough to walk up to him, that he knew if he wasn't of God, he was going down. God was going to do something with him right there.
He was bold enough to take action. And I think, you know, remember, be strong and courageous, don't fear. Well, we got a little strong and courageous, don't fear, with him walking up to him. And then being bold enough to ask that question, could this have been a test? Could this have been Abraham and Isaac on the mountain of sacrifice? All right, Joshua, you've said you trust me. Do you trust me? You know, confidentially, I already know you trust me, but you need to know you trust me. I think there's a lot of times that we get that. You know, we spoke of Abraham and Isaac. God knew that Abraham had the faith to plunge that knife. Abraham needed to know. A lot of times I think we come into tests in this life not because God questions us, but because we question ourselves. Am I committed enough? Am I strong enough? Do I believe enough? Do I have enough faith?
Faith will cancel fear just like fear will cancel faith.
They are direct opposites of each other. And you cannot entertain faith and fear at the same time, because they will cancel each other out. They'll mute each other. Okay. So, are you for us or are you for our enemies? Neither. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? He immediately said, okay, that title's enough for me. If you're commander of God's host, I am your servant. Command me. Okay? The commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy. And Joshua did so.
I got a question about that. Not that particular section there, but about the whole commander of the army of the Lord.
Okay.
It's kind of a two-part question. One, was he talking to Michael, the archangel? And two, could it have been the actual commander of the Israel army of the Lord, and kind of just backing Joshua up, saying, look, you're up here praying, trying to figure out things, what to do, and then no.
Joshua would not have acquiesced to a human being. He would not have fallen down to a human commander.
Okay.
Who was it?
It was Jesus.
It was Jesus. This is a what theologians call a theophany, which is a pre-incarnate appearance of the Son. Okay? Understand that up until the time that Mary gave birth to Jesus as a human baby, Jesus still existed in antiquity past.
Right?
He was always with the Father. And if you read the creation stories, and then you read how Paul interprets that later, you find out that everything that was made through Jesus. Right? Jesus is the living Word. God spoke, and creation was. Okay? So he was always there. And there are a few places in the Old Testament that theologians pretty much agree are theophanies, pre-incarnate appearances of God, or of Christ as God. And one of them is here. Anybody know where another one would be?
The tent?
Burning bush. The Abraham, the travelers that came to Abraham. Mm-hmm. Those are typically thought of as theophanies. Okay, God put his finger into the world.
And he told him the same thing he told Moses.
Which is?
Take off your sandals.
Take off your shoes. The place where you're standing is holy ground. Why? Why take off your shoes?
I think this might be thinking outside the box here, but shoes are man-made. Your feet are God-made.
There may be something there.
You know, and so he wanted touching natural.
It's a thing of reverence. At that point in the, you know, what was the custom to go into someone's home at that time?
Take
your shoes off, get your feet washed. Why? Because you wore sandals.
Your feet got dirty.
It was dirty. It was muddy. And there were critters out there that used the same street that you walked on.
You probably stubbed your toes and got them bloody.
So, you know, the idea, you know, what do we do? What things do we do out of respect when we enter someone's home today? Some people take shoes off. If you're wearing a hat, hat comes off, right? So, you know, there are still customs like that that show respect, okay? So,
and also, if an elder is speaking, or you say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am.
There are certain courtesies that go with positions of authority. You know, regardless of who's sitting in the White House, if you're invited to the Oval Office, you give attention to what's said. You don't interrupt. They will escort you out. You know. Authority and positions of authority and what have you are due a level of respect and reverence, particularly if you think that's God. Okay? If that is a God or a messenger of God, if it's Jesus, if it's the Holy Spirit, whatever, you know, the idea of put your shoes off, you're standing on holy ground, is it's respect. It's let's get that dirty man-made thing from between you and me. I like that, Shane. I hadn't really thought about it quite from that perspective, that particular angle, but I think it works. It works, you know. Let's get down to it here. It's just me and you. Also a little harder to run away with your shoes off. Okay. So, when does this encounter happen? It happens on the eve of the battle. That's a good point. But it also happens after the Brit Milah, after the circumcision, and after the celebration of Passover. Both of those things are commandments. Circumcision in Hebrew is Brit Milah. You know what Brit means? It's a covenant term. It's usually translated covenant, but literally it means to cut until the blood flows. But it's a symbol of making a covenant. So this encounter happens after they have affirmed their covenant with God, It happens after they have celebrated their deliverance, both of which were things God commanded them to do. So after, to put it in old church terms, after attendance to the holy ordinances, God shows up. Okay? And I think this showing up is twofold. It's certainly a test of Joshua. Are you going to cut and run? Are you going to stand and fight? What's your reaction going to be when this challenge comes? Okay? Are you ready to do what we're going to do in the next 7 days? Okay. But I think it's also a reinforcement. If I'm here and God told me to take that city, and there is this supernatural commander of God's army standing here with me, I want to have some confidence. Hey, it's not just a bunch of escaped slaves who wandered in the wilderness for 40 years and don't know anything about military maneuvers. God's army is here. If the captain of the host is here, the host is here.
Why didn't he? Okay, I know why he done it the way he done it, but why didn't he show himself to everybody in the camp? Why did he have to do it through Joshua so Joshua could go and say, you know, why didn't he say, okay, you guys are all part of this. You know, this, why did he give him the same pep talk that he gave Joshua?
Joshua was the leader.
He was God's representative to the people. Let me see here. I'm looking for the quote, but earlier in a chapter here we said what the scripture said, that God told Joshua, I'll begin to glorify you in the eyes of Israel as I did Moses. You know, when he led them across the river, you know, it was a confirmation that, yes, this is the leader I selected, right? Here's another deal that the glory ultimately goes to God, but for the people of Israel to do what they need to do, they needed to respect Joshua fully. So the authority, the orders, God's word to the people had to come through the anointed leader, because they had to have that, you know, look at a human being and say, you know, okay, what does God have to say? All right, we'll do it. Very much like a military chain of command. When you're in the military, you don't question the order, you execute the order. Because if you hesitate long enough to question, it may be too late. Right? So this is so it needed to be here.
And God chooses to flow through the leadership like that so that we can submit to them on the earth. Because in submitting to them on the earth puts us in authority in the spiritual realm.
And what Joshua did was necessary too, because it's necessary for those in leadership to submit to the greater authority. Right? My authority as an associate pastor here is only as good as my submission to the chain of command above me. Right? Otherwise you end up with Jonestown.
But it also, you know, to the congregation and those that are in leadership or whatever, that if they're not in submission to the leadership, like in this church here or in any church, then you have no authority in the spiritual realm. So when you say, I bind up whatever, you have no authority to bind it up because you're not in submission in the natural realm.
You got to be under the chain of command.
Right.
Okay. All right. That's good. The timing of this happened. We talked about, you know, it happens at this time where they have obeyed the ordinances, they've obeyed the commands of God, and now this encounter happens. The location is also important. After they crossed the river, they had not yet possessed any of the land of the promise, right? They crossed the river, they made camp, they did circumcision, they celebrated Passover. We've not won any territory. We've not possessed any land. We could say we put our marker up and we stack those 12 stones up. But they really haven't possessed anything yet. They're about to take their first step in possessing the land of the promise. So this encounter happens overlooking Jericho. What else happened after they crossed the river? The obvious manifestations of God's presence that they had lived with for the last 40 years stopped. The manna stopped. The column of fire, the column of cloud, those things went into the past. You see, for the last 40 years, these people had had a daily visual and tangible reminder that God was walking with them. They could see the cloud. They could see the fire. They could eat the manna. They had that visual thing. It was very elementary. The relationship did not require you to trust God, with the possible exception of gathering double portion of manna on Friday because it wasn't coming on Saturday. Okay? They didn't have to really trust God because they could see God. Well, as they enter into the land of the promise, the mechanics is changing. Now they don't have that visible manifestation. Now they don't have that daily manna. They have got to trust God. They have to live by faith, not by sight. Okay? This is a much more mature faith. If you can see the Master and follow the Master, then that's very simple. You do what he does, do what he tells you to do. You know, you don't have to think about it. You don't have to wonder because it's tangible. You can see it. But we're supposed to believe God and follow God, not because we can visibly see him, but because we believe in our heart that he is who he is. This requires some maturity of faith. We have to believe even when we don't see. What was it Jesus said to Thomas when he appeared after his resurrection? Blessed are you because you have seen the marks. But even more blessed are those who haven't seen but still believe. So this prefigures our age. You know, we don't get to see Jesus walking around with a bunch of people handing us fish out of a basket. We don't get to see that. But we have to believe that he's there. We have to believe that he still cares. We have to believe that he's going to take care of us in the same way that he did when he was walking around with that bunch of guys 2,000 years ago. Right? It's a faith. It requires a level of maturity. Because it's not blind hope. Faith has to have something to sit on. Right? Faith has to have a foundation. We read it in the Bible. We hear others testify to how God has come through in their lives. And we look back on our own lives and see how God's come through and when God has come through. And when we do that, we've got something to believe. Our belief is based on something tangible. And the more real that is to you, the stronger your faith will be. You know, it's one thing to read the Bible and say, well, yeah, I see where God came through, but that was 2,000 years ago and 6,000 miles away. What about today? It's another level when you say, but you know what? I remember when my grandpa was sick and my granny prayed and he was healed from his disease. Okay? That was 40 years ago and 40 miles away. But when you get your own track record, I can remember when God came through in my life when I was sick. I can remember when God came through in my life when I had a financial need. I remember when I was just so desperate to the point of maybe even thinking of taking my own life, and God sent somebody to talk to me. See, the closer it gets, the more real it is. You know, we can look at what the words of the Bible say, and some people can grab a hold of that and build their faith on that. And other people look at that and you say, well, yeah, that was then and there. This is now. What about me? It makes a big difference when you've got your own track record. New Testament says they overcame Satan by what? The blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony.
Loving their life, not
to them. So here we go. Testimony. Witness. Hey, Zita, I know you're struggling, but let me tell you what God did for me. Okay? Means something. That's why we're not to forsake the assembling ourselves together. Because we're supposed to hold each other up. We're supposed to build each other up. We're supposed to encourage not only ourselves, as we talked about in earlier chapters, but we need to encourage each other. We need to let them know, hey, God's real. And he's here, and I'm here too. If you need me, I'm here. That's how a church works. That's how a family's supposed to work. We're supposed to be here to help each other and to build each other up and to encourage each other on. That's the reason that Jesus set fivefold ministers in the church, right? To equip the saints for the work of the ministry. Who are the saints? If you're born again, you're a saint. Okay? You don't have to have two documented miracles and be dead for so long in an incorrupt body and the Pope say you're a saint. You know, Bible says a saint is a person who is sanctified, and you are sanctified by accepting Christ in your life. Therefore, if you're born again, you're a saint. I don't act like it. Well, fix it. All right. What do you make of that captain of the host having his sword drawn?
Authority.
When do you draw a sword?
When you want to make a stance.
When you're ready to fight.
When you're ready to fight. So what was getting ready to happen? They were getting ready to take a fortified city. And if the commander... We've all seen the old cavalry movies, right? You know, the captain whips his saber out, and what does everybody do behind him?
Charge.
Same thing. You know, they get their weapons at ready. So if the captain's got his weapon out, it's time to get your weapon out. We're going to do some fighting. Okay?
I think that when Joshua reacted the way he reacted, the battle started in the spiritual realm, then and there, because the sword was drawn.
This battle is fought on two levels?
Yes.
What two levels?
Spiritual and
the
natural.
Spiritual and the natural. Okay. So, are you saying then that there was probably a war between the angelic and demonic to go right along with the war between the Israelites and the citizens of Jericho?
I'm pretty sure Joshua's fighting war with himself, yeah, too.
What you bind on earth, I'll bind in him.
We have a hard time. We well-educated, intelligent, 21st century Americans have a much harder time than the ancients of thinking about demons and angels and spiritual battles. Let me tell you, honey, it's real.
Don't you need one?
Anyway, like I say, when you've been in a cat fight with one, you know.
It's like it's ready to call me. Right in your face. I get nervous.
There are people in this room that I know that have seen the angelic and have seen the demonic. And I know that there are some of us that have struggled mightily on that front. So, you know, yes, it's real. It's perhaps more real than this physical realm that we walk in. Floyd, you had a hand up there?
I was going to say, not to be mean, but I saw both. Because I talked to my mom and my stepdad and my grandma. But the apartment that I was staying at about a year or two ago had demonic in it. And you want to talk the hair standing on my arms and the back of my neck and everything. But I went and called my brother-in-law, which is an ordained minister, to ask about it. And he said, did you read the scripture? I can't remember what scripture he said, and we done it, and we kicked him out. But I tell you, that was one heck of a scare on both, not the my mom and my grandma and them, but the demonic part.
Here's the thing. Zeta talked about having authority. You have authority because you're under authority. You better be under authority when you start to fight those battles. Because the thing about it is, you know, you end up with
seven.
You're in a war, whether you know you're in a war or not. And when you take stand against the demonic, you know, there's a passage in the New Testament. Some people were trying to throw a demon out, and they came in and said, in the name of this Jesus that Paul preaches, I'll cast you out of here. And the demon responded to him and said, Jesus I know, and Paul I know.
Who are you?
Who are you? Which, in other words, he had no authority. He had no spiritual standing, therefore could not do that battle. Okay. So, you know, I think the drawn sword was, you know, if the commander's ready to attack, that's authorization for you to attack.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we're going to read about it in a second. We tend to sanitize a little bit the fall of Jericho. We talk about the earthquake and we talk about the walls falling down, but what we neglect to mention is that every man charged straight into the city from where you are
and wipe them out
with your sword drawn and wipe them out. You know, we tend to ignore that. There was a battle to be fought.
I'll open it up, but you go in there and do it.
Yep, I'll pop the top off the can. You kill the worms when they crawl out.
Yep.
Okay.
I submit to you that Joshua took the stand when he bowed his head out to the ground. That's when he took his stand.
He recognized that spiritual authority.
Yep.
And that
gave him authority.
That gave him the authority that put him squarely under submission of the captain of God's host. And the battle arguably was won at that point. At least it was set off on a good foot. Let's start to read some here in chapter 6. Now the gates of Jericho were securely barred because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one came in. You know, that is always one of the most interesting things to me. Here's a strong fortified city. Here's this bunch of ragtag Hebrews out there around. And they got the gates barred. Nobody's coming in. Nobody's going out. We're under siege. But remember what we read earlier. The word was out. The word was out what they'd done 40 years before on the other side of the river. The word was out that their God dammed up the river and let them come across on dry ground in flood. Word was out. These people have a powerful God behind them.
And you know what? Once word gets out, now there'll be more word to get out. Judging from the past.
It's about respect. Okay. You know, the people of Jericho had a healthy respect, maybe even a healthy fear of the Israelites.
Of their God.
Of their God. Of the God of the Israelites. You know, the whole interchange, we didn't read it in detail, but the whole interchange between Rahab and the spies, it was, you know, hey, you know, I perceive that your God's going to give you this city. You know, think about me and my family when y'all come in, please.
Tie the scarlet.
Okay.
I mean, look how she spoke. She spoke what was already done.
Yeah, exactly. See, there is, like, you know, it was, she recognized the fact that this thing had been ordained in heaven and it just needed to be walked out on earth. This is something that we need to grasp. As 21st century American Christians in Hazard, Kentucky, many of the things that God has promised us are done.
Amen.
We just need to learn how to walk in them. We can walk in deliverance because deliverance has been ordained. We can walk in victory because victory's been ordained. We can walk in holiness because holiness has been ordained.
Well, God can't do no more. He's already done it all.
He sat down.
I like the way April says it. April says, Jesus already purchased it. I just wrapped the check.
Yeah, money's in the account.
I love that way she said it. I just wrapped the check.
Then the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have delivered Jericho into your hands along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horn in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the army will go up. Everyone goes straight in. What idiot figured out this battle plan? That makes no sense. The Joint Chiefs would urge the President, the Commander-in-Chief, not to execute such a battle plan because it's utterly ridiculous. What are you going to do, tease them for 6 days?
Scare them to death.
And then,
don't you reckon about the 4th day, the people that was looking out thought, well, they've lost
every 11 lines. You know, there they go again. They haven't accomplished anything. They're just using up their supplies and their food and their water and their energy. When they finally do attack, we'll get them.
Yeah, on that 7th day, on that 7th trip around through there, and that all started falling. They wonder what's going on then.
How many of the people on the walls of Jericho went home and kicked back with a cold drink about the 3rd march around on that 7th day? Because they figured nothing's happened in the last 6 days. Nothing happened. That might have been part of the plan.
And they may have been running to the windows and looking out. And here they come again.
I don't think so. I think they were scared out of the
living. I think you were too.
I think every day they thought, is this the day?
Because they heard scared. What God's already doing.
Each day they were scared more,
even
more.
If they were truly in fear of the God of Israel, they didn't know what was going to happen. They knew something was going to happen. They knew it wasn't going to come out real good, but they didn't know what was going to happen or when it was going to happen. Okay.
I wanted to ask a question.
Okay.
The long blast on the trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
That means something, doesn't it? Long blast, short blast, and all that?
Yeah, I don't have that right at the tip of my tongue here, but there were 4 distinct trumpet calls that are used, and they do all have different meanings. The long blast is, I can't remember what you call it, but it's like Hagadol is attached to it, which means it's like the high priest. The high priest is the Kohen Hagadol. It means, you know, the highest. And, you know, there are certain trumpet calls that are sounds of warning and alarm. There are certain calls that proclaim it's time to battle. There is a call that proclaims the coming of the king, and that may be that long blast, come to think of it. I need to look that up again. It's been a while since I've studied that. But the thing about it is, yeah, you know, wouldn't that put the fear in you? You know, you've been in a room with one shofar with a blast like that, and the hair on your arm goes right straight up in the air. When you get that whole bunch of it, and then the host of Israel shouts. Notice when they shouted. Did they shout after the walls fell down?
No, before. That's what caused the walls to fall.
What if they had shouted?
It wouldn't have failed.
So when it came down to that 7th circuit and the long blast of the shofar was sounded and the people responded in faith and shouted, that's when the walls fell.
But
So a shout in faith is a statement that I believe God's going to do what he said he'd do.
You believe he's already done it?
He's already done it. He's already made already made the preparations for it. It's going to happen. So, you know, those were the instructions. You read the next several verses and find out they did exactly what God told them to do. And it's interesting that in verse 10, Joshua tells them, "Now y'all don't say a word until it's time to shout." Okay, just being silent. Why do you suppose he said that?
Silence unbelief.
How the poison could quickly have spread. We're walking around the city. Boy, this is the stupidest thing we have ever done. I don't see what this is going to accomplish. Here we go, walking around the city in the dust. It's sunny. You know, I could be in my tent right now.
Let's just wait and go on the lights
now. I want to go back and address what Zita was asking about the long blast of the trumpet.
Okay. That's fine.
I found out a commentator here, and I like how it says it. It says, "The trumpet horn was used to awaken the people as well, to arouse them to get moving. In Joshua, the trumpet blast caused a wall to come down in Jericho and disintegrate. I found in many places it was used to declare victory before it even happened." I like that. The practice wasn't always associated with war, however. Trumpets were blown for a time of celebration, such as when the people gathered together during a feast time. So it was the long blast of the trumpet was a call to action, but it was also a call to celebration at the same time.
There, like I said, there are four.
In other words, you're saying it's a victory blast.
Yep.
There are four distinct shofar calls that are talked about biblically. One of them is a two-tone repeated three times. Do-do, do-do, do-do. And then there's the Shevarim, which is a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then there is the regular blast, which is a two-tone also. Is da-da. And then the great blast is that last one, as long and as loud as you can blow. And they do each have distinct meaning. The staccato, the da-da-da-da-da, is an alarm. I think the two-tone, the first two-tone when they repeated three times is like a call to worship. And I believe the great blast is proclaim the coming of the king. But I need to do a little more research before I stand on that and tell you definitively that that's correct. Okay. All right. Joshua got up early, in verse 12. Joshua got up early the next morning, and the priest took up the ark, and the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets went forward, marching before the ark of the Lord and blowing the trumpets. Armed men went ahead of them, and on the rear guard followed the ark of the Lord while the trumpets kept sounding. That would be aggravating, though, wouldn't it? These people walking around your town blowing trumpets.
They'd drive in people inside that wall nuts.
So our intelligent people didn't come up with that trying to drive Noriega crazy, huh? Blast that crazy rock and roll music and make them crazy. So they did that the first day and they did it for 6 days. On the seventh day, in verse 15, they got up at daybreak and marched around the city seven times in the same manner, except that on that day they circled the city seven times. The seventh time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the army, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you'll make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury." So basically what's going on here is this. When they say these things are devoted, armies of the time and even armies of the present time are well known for taking the spoils of war. You know, we break into this house, well, there's a nice necklace, thank you very much, that goes in my pocket, I'll take it home to my wife. Okay? Oh, hey, there's a gold bar, I believe I'll take that. Well, there's one of the enemy's weapons, I'll take that home. You know, time honored. In this time, normally, all of the goods that were worth having, the clothing, the tools, the carts, the livestock, you know, typically you go seize a city and you take all that stuff. Jericho is the first fruits of the conquest of the land. And according to the biblical law, first fruits are, they're devoted to God. You make a first fruit offering, then you get to partake of the rest of the things. So basically what was to happen here was this. If it was alive in Jericho and not in Rahab's house, it was to be killed. People, children, livestock,
every
living thing was to be killed. And yeah, God had a reason for that. If it was worth something, if it was gold or silver or bronze, it was to go into the treasury of God. Okay? Everything else was to be destroyed. Don't pick up that trinket and take it home with you. I know that's a real nice suit of clothes, but don't pick it up and take it home with you. It belongs to God. It's devoted. It's first fruits. See, that's the thing that a lot of people miss in this. You know, why in the world would they do that? But remember, they hadn't possessed the land of the promise. This was the first fruits of the possession. So Jericho belonged to God. Okay. As we find out shortly thereafter, not everybody obeyed these instructions.
Yeah, they got
trouble. I want to know something. Is this like, I mean, I know tithes is the first fruit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with what happened to them that decided they wanted some of it, that's what happens to us today, isn't it?
Shall a man rob God?
Yeah. Is it the same? I mean, is that kind of like showing us
the consequences? The consequences are, if you give God the first fruits, you're operating under God's blessing. If you rob God of the first fruits that belong to Him, you place yourself under the curse, and you are liable for whatever may come your way. God didn't do it to you. You did it by not obeying God. Now, understand, first fruits, if you read the Old Testament law, if you read the first five books, first fruits of everything belong to God. First fruits are your crops, you offer to God, then you can reap your crops. The first offspring that breaks the womb of one of your animals belongs to God. If it's a small animal, if it's a sheep, you sacrifice it. If it's a cow, you can redeem it. Okay? If it's more valuable. The first fruit that breaks the womb of a woman belongs to God. We don't do human sacrifice. No, we don't. You're to redeem the firstborn. There is a sacrifice done, a substitutionary sacrifice done that actually prefigures what Jesus is going to do for us. But there's a substitute. But the first of your increase belongs to God, regardless of what it is. And basically, you know, if you look at Jericho as the first fruits of the land of the promise, then Jericho belongs to God. Okay.
Well, let me just make one thing here about the shell.
Yes.
I was looking at word up to see what it meant. It's the Hebrew T-E-R-U-A-H.
Teruah.
And it says to cry out and shout. And it says it is an ear-piercing great noise, a sound that cannot be ignored.
And that, by the way, is one of the words for one of the trumpet calls. The is a teruah, and the great one is a teruah hagadol. Teruah, tekiah, Shevarim.
So,
yeah.
This is just totally different, but I just wanted to ask a question.
Yeah.
Like in Isaiah, where it's talking about all these different ways, in Isaiah 12, it talks about, you know, to sing to the Lord, to make mention his name is exalted, to declare his deeds among the people, and it says, cry out and shout. Is that not a time where it's like a battle cry, you know, or a victory?
Proclaim the victory.
There has to be some kind of significance.
Shout to the Lord, all the earth, let us sing. Power and majesty, praise to the King. And we used to sing that one. The mountains bow down and the seas roar at the sound of your name.
But I mean, you know, sometimes when you're in battle and you are pressed down to the enemy and just battled and battled and battled and battled, and you just say that's enough and just no.
It sets fear in the heart of your enemy. And plants courage in your own heart when you shout in the midst of the battle. All right, I guess we've reached our time. We'll pick on up from there next week. Be blessed. We'll see y'all Sunday.